Many years ago, this church's founding minister, Reverend Dr. Robert Myers, often preached on movies and novels. Dr. Myers felt that contemporary fiction in all of its forms was useful in showing to us great theological and moral ideas and themes. I remember sitting out there, more correctly up there in the choir, and being mesmerized by his words. It fascinated me that we could turn to fresh, contemporary, and entertaining ideas to inform our rather dusty faith. To say that this was inspiring is an understatement. So when I had the opportunity last semester to enroll in a course at Phillips Theological Seminary called Theological Themes in the Contemporary Novel, I jumped at the chance. Taught by Dr. Joe Bessler, we were to read 6 novels over the 13 weeks of the semester. It was an online class, so we were to prepare various postings to an online messaging board and listen to weekly lectures and meditations from Joe. There were written essay requirements, and the culmination of the course could be either a paper on a topic from the course or the preparation of a sermon based on ideas gleaned from the course. It appears that I chose the sermon option, and you are now listening to my final exam from this class. I'd like to look at 3 distinct ideas this morning. First, I want to discuss the class in general terms, the experience, the work, the frustrations, and the joys of this type of learning. Secondly, I want to look at the overarching theme of this class, sociological haunting. More on this in a minute. And finally, I want to comment on just a few of the novels and my experience with reading them in this format. In 2006 and 2007, I developed the first online courses and a complete online program of study for the Wichita Area Technical College. I built upon an existing resource of online materials that the college had in place, but I was tasked with taking it to the next iteration and putting an entire class in an online format. I'm saying this to you so that you know I come to online education with some knowledge and some experience of this type of learning. My chief observation from my time at WATC is that no amount of technology can ever replace a talented instructor. The entire class experience ultimately rests with the instructor. Now, I know many of us have had abysmal experiences with online education, and I know that we've also had some excellent experiences as well. I've taken a number of online classes at Phillips, and I find my previous comment to hold true. It is ultimately the instructor's responsibility to lead a useful educational experience. And this course that we had on contemporary novels was an excellent example of this type of education. Now, if you've never taken an online class, let me tell you that the key skill for success for the student is time management. You have to map out your week so that you give yourself ample time to do all of the reading and then complete the required postings and writing assignments. Dr. Bessler was spot on with each week's materials being made available on Friday or Saturday for the coming week. I would start each Monday at my desk about 6 o'clock a.m. with my morning beverage in hand and that week's audio lectures and meditations ready to go. It was a wonderful way to begin my week. I would also then begin mapping out my posting schedule for the week. We usually had our initial post due by Tuesday, and our responses to our co-students' posts were due by Thursday. On top of this, I had another online class, plus my concentrated class, and all of the regular stuff I do for you all during the week. This past semester was plenty busy, and I loved every single minute of it. Of the 6 novels that we were assigned, there were additional readings as well. We had some essays that Dr. Bessler would post weekly, and then we would comment on these as well. And also, Dr. Bessler gave his weekly lectures and meditations, and sometimes hidden within these, there would be additional assignments to complete. So you had to listen. I always look forward to Dr. Bessler's meditations as he has this soft and calming voice that made you feel like he was right there next to you discussing the text at hand. His voice was so warm and personable that I came to look forward to his meditations and lectures each week. I'm going to kind of miss him, but I downloaded them all, so I have a full library that I can return to anytime I need to. One important aspect of this course was for us to begin developing a discerning eye towards the development of theologies in modern writing. What this means is that we were to basically pay close attention to where God was in these stories, how the people used their religion, and whether or not there was any theology that informed the stories. And this was very tricky, but it was a great way for me to begin my own personal work on systematic theology, and that is the practice of looking for and identifying theological systems, or ways of thinking theologically, ways of thinking about God. It's a big concept, and one I know that I will be working on for the rest of my life. As I said, this class was a good way to begin developing these skills in systematic theology, and I will also need these skills for the rest of my ministry. The overarching theme of this class was this idea of sociological haunting. Here's a definition in the words of Avery Gordon, who wrote Ghostly Matters, one of our texts for the class. Sociological haunting is a constitutional element of modern social life. It is neither pre-modern superstition nor individual psychosis. It is a generalizable social phenomenon of great importance. To study social life, one must confront the ghostly aspects of it. So what exactly am I talking about with ghosts and sociological haunting? After the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there remained physical, spiritual, and sociological haunting. That is, the remnants of that past event lingered in a variety of forms and incarnations. The creation and popularity of the hideous monster Godzilla is a direct example of sociological haunting. A society that has had atomic war visited upon it should be expected to require some healing in regards to the use of atomic energy in other forms, such as energy production or medicine. So we get the physical consequences, Godzilla, from the acts of violence, and then from the new use of atomic energy. The haunting, or the ghost of the bombs, has lived on in the psyche of the Japanese spirit. I would argue that it continues on in the creative use of the manga art and the universe of characters that inhabit that fictive realm. Another example would be how traumatized the British people were by the German Luftwaffe air raids on London and other cities during World War II. To this day, we can see a sociological haunting and a fear of things dropping from above, all the way from Tolkien and C.S. Lewis up to our modern Doctor Who television series. The British people have a distinct fear of danger from above, and a very specific reference for their underground tubes and shelters. Here in America, we have a number of our own types of haunting. Think of the types of popular movies during and immediately following World War II. Most of the popular entertainment had to do with ghosts. Think of the musicals Carousel, or Brigadoon, or the films Topper, or Here Comes Mr. Jordan. America was dealing with the tragic death of thousands of young people, young lives that were cut down in their prime and were unable to see fruition. It makes sense that our national psyche would look at ways to deal with these cut short lives. Also, in America, we have the ghastly ghost of slavery. And that brings us to one of the six novels that we read. We read Alice Parker's The Color Purple. I cannot stress enough that sentence. We read Alice Parker's The Color Purple. We read it, we chewed on it, we discussed it, we dissected it, we wrote our own ideas in our postings, we ruminated on this story. The Color Purple is the story of Miss Seeley, a freed woman in the Deep South of Georgia. It is set in the 1930s. And through the brilliant use of letters to God and diary entries and letters to her sister and other people, Miss Seeley tells her story. And what a story it is. We don't have time this morning to review the entire storyline, so suffice it to say that if your only experience with Miss Seeley's story is through the Steven Spielberg movie, you're missing quite a lot. There's something about Miss Seeley's voice in her letters that pulls you into her story. There, when she writes of being abused by her father, you cringe in terror and revulsion. When she writes of her betrayal of Miss Sophie, she basically tells Miss Sophie's new husband to beat her. When she writes of that, you see the consequences of this act. You feel her guilt and her anxiety seep across the pages and into your eyes. It's a powerful experience. And when you read of the eventual reconciliation of Miss Seeley's family and how Miss Seeley will endure, you might shed a tear of joy that it did all work out. I was taken by how Miss Seeley's theology evolves throughout the novel. In Miss Seeley's theology, at the beginning of the novel, God is out there somewhere looking down on creation. And this theology serves Miss Seeley very well. I wrote in one of my postings that I thought Miss Seeley used God as sort of a sounding board for her thoughts and her ideas. She throws out questions in her diary entries, and she saw how they felt and sounded. More often than not, in the first half of the novel, Miss Seeley works out her own problems, but she always felt the presence of a loving God. There's a point in the novel where Miss Seeley first feels true love towards another person. Shug Avery is a lounge singer and an old paramour of Miss Seeley's husband. Shug Avery is a beautiful, though flawed woman, and Miss Seeley develops a strong attachment to this woman. This lesbian love story is just one more piece of wood on the fire that is the controversy surrounding The Color Purple. People love to ban this book. I will share a little secret with you. Nothing makes me want to read a novel more or see a movie more than when it is on someone else's banned list. This reminds me of Heinrich Heine's, when he said, "Where they burn books, they will soon burn people." So the experience of human love that Miss Seeley felt, it causes her to begin to see God in a new manner. And there's a biblical parallel between Seeley's dramatic shift from this distant God when she writes, "You have to get man off your eyeball before you can see anything at all." There's a biblical parallel between that and the verse from Acts that's in your bulletin about Paul's conversion. "And scales fell from Paul's eyes, and he could see again. He got up and was baptized." Many things can blind us from God. Addictions, diversions, anger, resentment, the list goes on. But the spiritual maturation that occurs in this scene, what happens to Miss Seeley, it makes every scene following this make perfect sense. It seems like everything is better for Seeley after the scales are removed from her eyes. She doesn't write to God again until the very end. She only writes to the people who mean the most to her. I think this scene opens Seeley's eyes to a God that is no longer distant, but very real and very present in her world. She begins to pay close attention to this and to the relationships that she has remaining. It's a great novel, and I think one we should read every so often to remind us of these ghosts and the haunting of our slaveholder past, a past I fear that we would all just prefer to forget. The very first book we read is called My Name is Asher Lev. It's a sweeping novel about a young Hasidic Jewish artist growing up in Brooklyn and how his powerful talent for art clashes with his incredibly close-knit Jewish community. At times, this story reminded me of our familiar tale of Fiddler on the Roof. They are both about communities that are trying to keep their traditions alive in an ever-encroaching secular world, and how those people living in those communities change and adapt, or not. Usher Lev is a haunting tale in its own right, and I encourage you to read it. We read a powerful book about the Holocaust and its effects called Fugitive Pieces. This story is about a young survivor of a Nazi roundup in his Polish village who was eventually rescued by a Greek archaeologist. The book follows our protagonist's eventual emigration to Canada, where he becomes a famous poet. The second part of the book deals with another man who teaches on his poetry. It is all too easy to dismiss the Holocaust or write it off as another horrible example of man's inhumanity to man. We busy Americans don't have time to dwell on these past horrors. I ask you to dwell once in a while upon this event. Not only is it important for us to remember that all humans are capable of this type of madness, this mass extermination of humans, but it is also important that we think about how different our world would be today if those lives had not ended prematurely. Sometimes I like to sit back and honor the memories of those lost in the Shoah with a simple prayer or a meditation or the simple thought, I wish they could be with me today on my bike ride. All of those little acts that we take for granted that they didn't get to know again. I'm willing to bet that they would not mind having a job to go to or having to attend a lecture, the banality of another family dinner, the deep boredom of a phone call from that person, the endless pursuit of paying our bills. The next time you're bored, think of those who don't have the luxury of being bored, those that would love to be alive and bored right now. Another book we read was my least favorite, and it was the most important. It was the third on our list. We read it last March. It was a science fiction novel called The Sparrow. It was written by Mary Doria Russell, and it concerns itself with the discovery of life on a distant planet. Through various machinations, it ends up that a starship is sent to this planet by the Jesuits. Yes, yes. The Jesuits are space explorers in this novel. Now, don't get me wrong. In retrospect, I realize that this is an important novel. It is actually about colonialism and its effects on the indigenous peoples of conquered lands. It has a brisk narrative, and it arrives at some compelling questions regarding God and God allowing evil in the universe. You could call it, When Bad Things Happen to Good Aliens, and you wouldn't be very far off. I didn't like it very much. I thought that the author got most of the science and the biology wrong, and I really disliked what she did to the protagonist at the end of the story. Why I call this the most important novel we read, though, was because of what happened to me during our work with this novel. I won't go into all the details, but there is a gruesome plot twist towards the end that I thought was contrived and not necessary to get the author's points across. I was pretty riled up when I posted my first response. Let me read you a little of that posting. I feel violated by what was done to Emilio. I was horrified by what happened to him, and numerous times during the narrative, I asked myself, why the hell am I reading this awful story? I know what the author was trying to do in regards to colonialism and the law of unintended consequences, but it was all wasted on me by the end because I felt so terribly manipulated by Emilio's repeated abuse. I'm not naive. I know this happens in our world all the time. I just don't understand why Russell, the author, felt she had to use this story to convey these ideas, I was completely pulled out of the narrative, and my empathy for the characters was morphed into extreme dislike for the novel. As you can well imagine, I had instant writer's remorse when I hit the post button. And I knew then that those words were going to be read by my classmates and my professor. I imagined all sorts of repercussions. How dare you criticize this great literary work? Who are you to deny these events when the Europeans did the exact same things to the natives here? Where's your compassion for the fictional aliens? And while there was a little bit of that in a few of the posts, the response from my professor proved to be the most surprising. He acknowledged my view. He called it what it was, a rant. And then he proceeded to outline what I had taught him about the novel in my churlish way. Here are Dr. Bessler's words. Paul, I appreciate you recognizing the genre of a rant, and I think you can also understand why I don't want to encourage rants in the classroom. That said, I also appreciate the questions that the novel raises as well as the emotions that it has clearly triggered. For example, your criticism of the author's knowledge of science seems to work as a genre criticism. Because you are so well-versed in science fiction as a genre, I can see where one might be disappointed with respect to those expectations. So as to one, to this point in his life, who has had relatively little interest in science fiction, as such, I learned something helpful from your critique. Also, with respect to your sense that the author has given us here is totally inappropriate, I remember my first response the first time I read this novel. While not outraged, I was somehow nonplussed that this whole intergalactic journey has at its centerpiece the victimization of rape. So instead of being bashed for being critical, I get a point-by-point examination of my critique and positive feedback. Well, this was very important for me. It is difficult for me to put out criticism. I want to like everything, and I go out of my way to avoid conflict. When I pushed the entry key on what I thought would be a contentious post, expecting to be corrected, instead, I was shown in a very kind manner how to perform this type of criticism. I hadn't missed the mark by much, but I had doubted my ability, and Dr. Bessler was pointing out that a criticism can be valid if supported with fact. It was a key learning for me from this course. Early in our first novel, last February, I believe, we had just completed our first set of postings for the novel, My Name is Asher Lev. We students had had a good time pulling our ideas together and communicating on each other's work and diving deep into this story. Dr. Bessler sent us an email about our work. I awoke this morning and after a cup of coffee, checked our discussion board. I just want to say, very good work, folks. Felt as if I was sitting amongst a community of very thoughtful and engaging rabbis. Strong work. Keep imagining in your posts that you are showing us something that we may not have noticed, connections we need to catch. All of our follow-up conversations will be stronger for it. Sitting amongst a community of thoughtful and engaging rabbis. You can imagine what this praise and encouragement meant to a group of struggling seminary students. I know what it meant for me. It meant that I was being included in this group of rabbis, and that I had something of value to give to them. And it meant that our work was being noticed by our elders, as it were, that the work that we were doing had value, was engaging, was useful. Our work was useful. Who would have thought that a deep dive into six novels could have provoked such thinking, such heart, such bravery, and such affection? I am grateful for this class, for its wise professor. I'm grateful for my seminary, and I am very grateful for this congregation. Amen. Our closing song is found in your bulletin. Please stand if you are able. As you leave our sylvan glade and go out into the hot, hot world, look for those spaces where God is hiding. Have a great week. Amen.